This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Well, imagine you're sitting at home watching TV and all of a sudden the screen goes blank and all the lights go out. You wait for the power to return, but nothing happens. The longer you sit in the dark, the more you start thinking about how dependent you are on electricity. Millions across Spain, Portugal and parts of France have been left without power today after a massive outage.
The streets of cities across Spain and Portugal were plunged into chaos as traffic lights went out and public transport ground to a halt. Authorities urged the public not to call an ambulance unless it's a real emergency. Supermarkets with generators were inundated with customers panic buying, not knowing when the power might come back on.
In this program, John Timmer, senior editor of Ars Technica, explains why they can't just switch the power back on after the grid goes down. Going from a black start can take days. After reviews and on-the-ground reporting from the blackout in Spain and Portugal, we will get you out of there to Shangri-La.
To Shangri-La.
A world expert on deep time, Professor Robert Spicer, joins us. Is there a warning there too? Years ago, scientists predicted times too hot for human survival outside. Those days have arrived. In April, heat was in the 40s, way over 100 degrees Fahrenheit for over a billion people. North India is hellish. It's terrible in Delhi, a month before the hot season. The red-hot band of heat stretches from the Middle East, punishing across Iran for weeks, deadly in Afghanistan and Iran, sweeping through China and drenching Thailand and Southeast Asia in sweat. North America gets alternative storms of summer-like heat and then cool, while Britain just recorded the hottest May 1st since record-keeping began hundreds of years ago. Australia is too hot. The Pacific Islands are suffering. This is half a world in extreme heat outside the summertime, and it doesn't make the news. It was a pleasant 70 degrees Fahrenheit, 21°C in Madrid when the power died. Grid failure knocked out electricity all over Spain, Portugal, and pockets in southern France. Imagine that in one of the heat waves that dominate Iberia in recent years. Experts agree there will be more power failures during and because of climate change. A study predicted a citywide blackout in Phoenix during a heat wave could lead to thousands of deaths and require emergency medical attention for nearly half of the population. Blackouts happen all over the world. Around the same time as Spain went dark, the UK grid operator reported strange shifts in electric frequency. They're investigating. It did not reach a blackout. A few days after the Spanish grid collapsed, the Indonesian island of Bali went black. Power failures in recent years killed hundreds of people in Texas and many hundreds in North India. All of us need to know how this works. Here are a few news clips about sudden blackout, first from DW, Deutsche Welle, the German news service, and then from France 24 TV. Correspondent Sarah Morris reports from Madrid during the blackout to DW News, the German public broadcast service.
So people were scurrying around to try to find radios, old-fashioned radios with batteries, trying to find out exactly what was going on, and they didn't know what was the cause of that power outage and how long it would last. We saw people walking miles, Francois, to pick up their children to get home from work. The trains and metros weren't operating, and tens of thousands of people across the country had to be rescued from those trains, and some people actually had to stay the night in stations like Atocha in Madrid, but many others opened specifically to let people who couldn't get home sleep out in them, and that was really quite unsettling for many people. The worst affected were the vulnerable, and we understand that as many as five people may have died as a result of some of the consequences of power outages, including a family that were using a faulty generator and somebody else whose oxygen machine needed that vital electricity. And given the scale of the outage, Francois, it probably is a miracle that no more lives were lost. The hospitals continued to use generators and to triage and to handle emergency cases only. And many people talking today at just how much common sense ordinary Spaniards showed as they went about their business.
That was from Deutsche Welle, April 28, 2025. Next up, Professor Benjamin Sovacool from the University of Sussex on France 24 the same day with great tips about electric grids that we all depend on.
But I can tell you, the data that we have kind of talks about how about 87% of power outages are caused by weather or natural disasters. But there is a surprising 12% are caused by system inadequacy. So it's basically grids that just need upgraded, grids that are using old technology or perhaps not really strong digital controls that just fail. And then the remaining percentage of blackouts, about 2%, are actually caused by intentional or malicious attacks or interference by third-party stakeholders. The European grid is more integrated than the United States grid. You even have states like Texas, which has its own grid called ERCOT, which makes it very vulnerable to disruptions like the winter storm that caused a massive blackout and even deaths in Texas a few years ago.
That was from France 24, the state-owned television network, April 28th. The quiet dread behind the new miracle world. What if the power suddenly goes out? Nothing works, you are stuck, cut off from the outside world. Millions of people in Spain and Portugal just went through that. Just after noon, everything stopped. The grid crashed on Monday, April 28th, and did not return for several days. Why not? Why couldn't authorities just throw a switch and fill the wires with juice? The best answers come from John Timmer over at Ars Technica. John is senior editor at that famous tech journal. He has a doctorate in molecular and cell biology from the University of California, Berkeley. Timmer is a published researcher and a science communicator. His article is, Spain is about to face the challenge of a black start. This is for all of us. John Timmer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for inviting me on.
So the first question is kind of obvious. What is a black start?
So a black start is basically getting power onto a grid that has none flowing through it at the moment.
Pretty clear. Okay, let's assume the grid is down over a big area and millions are suddenly without power and nobody knows what caused it. Is it proper for grid operators to try a cold restart when the cause is unknown? Does that complicate the first decisions?
So I would say that as the grid operators start to bring equipment back on, they'll have immediate readouts if anything is faulty. So as they go about the process of bringing equipment back online, putting electricity through it, they'll know if something was at fault. So even if they run into the cause of the original blackout, they should be able to identify it very quickly and find ways of working around it.
Good to hear. All right, now, why can't the power companies just click on software or throw a few switches and start the grid again?
Oh, so many reasons. You know, for starters, software depends on power, and in the case of managing the grid, it needs power both of the control hardware and the hardware it's controlling, and it needs a viable communication network between the two. So there's a lot going on to make sure that they can actually do any work whatsoever. Adding to the complication is the fact that, you know, modern electric hardware expects to operate with the alternating current oscillating at a certain frequency. So alternating current, it just means current that, you know, goes back, the charge goes back and forth from positive to negative. And the frequency of how quickly it switches between those two extremes is the frequency of the grid. And all of our electric hardware on that expects a certain frequency. And if you try to feed something else to it, you can cause permanent damage to some of that hardware. The challenge is that when all the appliances, all the heating systems, all the cooling systems, everything we've got plugged in and onto the grid is unpowered, there's a tremendous amount of demand out there. And demand changes the frequency. So if we just immediately put power in the grid, the frequency would go off and all the protective systems we have would shut it down. So you'd be turning the power on and having it shut back down immediately. And nobody really wants that. So there's a long process involved in making sure you maintain the grid's frequency as you gradually add all those devices back onto the grid.
Yeah, it's such a weird balancing act, and we really know very little about it in the public. In the nuclear power plant disasters in Japan in 2011, they couldn't restart reactors or even safety cooling without electricity from an outside source. And it strikes us as so strange. I mean, here are these big power plants that produce electricity, but they can't start unless they get power from somewhere else. How does that work?
There's two aspects there. One is nuclear plants themselves, and the second is most other forms of electricity. So nuclear plants, in general, have backup generators purely to ensure that they can continue to circulate coolant waters to keep the plant from melting down. And their priority when they lose power is to make sure the plant goes cold in that they shut off the nuclear reactions before that backup power runs out. So a nuclear plant will take itself, most nuclear plants are designed to take themselves offline and shut down whenever an external power source is lost. Now, something like a hydroelectric dam or a gas-fired generating station doesn't have that same sort of risk. However, all of them are dependent on things like valves and pumps and things like that to keep material flowing through them. And those require power to operate. And in fact, the generators themselves usually rely on electromagnets that need power to operate as well. So if you lose power, all these things have basically shut down and there's no way to restart them because it just takes power to start making power.
So why didn't the Spanish operators just call in electricity from neighboring countries, at least to get their own generators going?
Because, you know, you need to think of the electrical wires as a bit like a pipe. They have a finite capacity. So one, there's only so much power you could bring in from neighboring countries. And then two, you have to make sure that power has a safe way of transiting to the power plants as opposed to being used to meet the demand of all our appliances and air conditioners and such. Because if it goes to meet the demand, it'll be overwhelmed and you'll have the same problem I mentioned earlier. So it's possible to use power from neighboring countries. In the case of the most recent blackout, there are connections to both France and Morocco available. As with everything else we've been talking about, it's not as simple as throwing a switch and bringing that power in. It needs to be able to be directed to very specific locations.
So the right-wing press, particularly in the UK for some reason, immediately blamed the blackout on Spain's dependence on renewable energy. If I understood your article correctly, you found solar and wind could help a fast reboot of the grid, but only if they have different interface hardware? Is that how it works?
Right. So it doesn't take much to generate power from solar power. So you get direct current whenever the light's hitting. So that's something that could help with this process. However, it gets back to the grid frequency again. The direct current from the solar panel needs to be converted to alternating current before it's put back on the grid. So it needs to go from a constant flow of charge to, again, the alternation between positive and negative charges. So there is hardware that does that conversion. There are two types of hardware from the perspective of this issue. There is hardware that could sense what the grid is doing and will create an alternate current to match that. Or there is hardware that can determine what frequency it wants to create and will just produce that. And so if you're trying to match the alternating current of a grid that's not functioning, you can't, you know, there's nothing to do there. It just won't work. So you need that specialized type of hardware that can dictate what the frequency is before it puts the power on the grid.
So, on Deutsche Welle TV, Professor Benjamin Sovacool from the University of Sussex says we should expect more blackouts in Spain, more often, because climate change means a lot more heat there and other extreme weather conditions. He thinks blackouts could double in Spain in the next 15 years. What do you think about grid failures increasing as climate change bites in?
It definitely has the potential. Climate change has the potential to raise the demand for electricity. You know, there's a lot of days where countries that wouldn't face extreme temperatures will be doing so. And so all these countries that never have had air conditioning before will start to install it in homes, and that'll just increase the demand. And also, you know, we're electrifying our vehicles, and that will increase the demand and so on and so forth. So grids need to be expanded and modernized to deal with that. Otherwise, yeah, it's likely over the next few decades we will see blackouts increasing.
When Texas went dark in the winter of 2021, it took more than 2 weeks to restore electricity to most areas. About 200 people died from either hypothermia or carbon monoxide poisoning from their generators. Is America in better shape for possibly increasing black starts in the next decade or two?
There are about four major grids in the U.S., so I don't think you can really say, you know, there's not a single answer to that. You know, each grid has its own distinct properties and some things that, you know, make demand different on them. There's not a single answer. What I would say is that one of the big things that's incredibly helpful both for avoiding blackouts in the first place and for returning to service afterwards is the presence of large grid-scale battery storage systems, because those can produce energy that will handle sudden spikes in demand, which might otherwise cause a blackout. And they can also put energy out on the grid at any frequency at any time, as long as they've not been fully drained. So if you're watching what's happening, both Texas and California are installing tens of gigawatts of batteries each year. And they're being installed in order to handle an occasional excess in production of renewable energy. And you can use that to take the solar that's made in the day and handle the nighttime demand. But at the same time, they'll really help with grid stability and grid restoration when it comes to that. At the moment, Spain doesn't have a lot of battery power, which may have contributed to this.
Just for the doomers out there in my listening audience, is there any scenario where you think the grid could go down suddenly and then not come back, say, for months, leading to a breakdown of civilized society? Could that happen?
It's very unlikely. It would require widespread damage of equipment that can't be replaced at any time, you know, at any reasonable amount of time. The Spanish and Portuguese grid operators got, you know, the entire Iberian Peninsula largely back into service in under 12 hours. It was an impressive feat. Most of the problems we've had in the States, where it's been longer, it's been a problem associated with the weather and, you know, weather, extreme weather that makes things difficult to restore service doesn't tend to last for, you know, multiple weeks or months.
Do you see opportunities to redesign more resilient systems in a fragile electric landscape?
Oh, absolutely. There has been money in recent bills like the Inflation Reduction Act and the Infrastructure Act that were passed during the Biden administration. They contain money for expanding and modernizing the grid. There are things we can do, and things are in progress. And as I said, you know, building more batteries helps as well. So there's definitely options for improving. We're doing some of them. As usual, we could do more and we could do more efficiently.
As we wrap up here, is there anything else you would like to talk about or tell our listeners?
It's very easy to get complacent about the things we rely on for our day-to-day life, a steady supply of power, water, things like that that are just part of our normal background, and we take them for granted. But there are a lot of complicated systems behind all those and a lot of people dedicated to working on them. And it costs money. And, you know, we should be prepared to spend what we need and support the people who are doing this work in order to make sure that we can continue to rely on these services in the future.
From Ars Technica, we've been speaking with Senior Editor John Timmer, and you can look for his enlightening article, Spain is About to Face the Challenge of a Black Start. I really recommend you read that. You can find more discussion and a link in my show blog at ecoshock.org. John, thank you for helping us on such short notice.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
So what caused the great blackout in Spain and Portugal? Even the suspicions are illuminating. The first reaction on social media and then denied by the Spanish government, the grid was sabotaged by a cyber attack. British tabloids said the Russians did it. Authorities deny it, but obviously millions of people and those in power consider a hidden war by grid sabotage is possible. There's a deep rabbit hole of news and reports and speculation on that. My shallow assessment, some nation states may have grid attack capabilities, but so far small groups and individuals cannot bring it down. Artificial intelligence tools may change that. Hopefully no angry teen in a basement holds us hostage. Several insurance companies, including Lloyd's, have modeled out the risks of attacks on the U.S. power grid. You can find links to all of that in my show blog at ecoshock.org. You may remember the virus designed to attack physical infrastructures in Iran connected with the nuclear program called Stuxnet. It was designed by another state and it got away into other countries. The first real cyber attack on a grid was in late 2016 when hackers damaged a transmission facility north of Kyiv, blacking out part of the capital of Ukraine. It only lasted an hour, but that may have been a test run for something bigger. Since then, the Russians have sent thousands of missiles and drones to blow up the electricity system for all of Ukraine. There are lots of reports on countries with plans to black out power grids as a first step of war or maybe a hidden war. No wonder this was the first suspicion in Spain and Portugal, but now both governments say it was not a cyber attack, but some kind of system failure. The second suspect paraded before us, Portugal's national grid operator, REN, said a rare atmospheric event could have caused the blackout. They later withdrew this explanation, but the possibility is important to understand, and more so with climate change. You need an electrical engineer to explain the phenomenon of induced atmospheric vibration. Professor Saeed Bambudian from the Swinburne University of Technology explains it in the conversation, quote, in simple terms, it seems to refer to wave-like movements or oscillations in the atmosphere caused by sudden changes in temperature or pressure. These can be triggered by extreme heating, large-scale energy releases such as explosions or bushfires, or intense weather events. When part of the Earth's surface heats up very quickly, due to a heat wave, for example, the air above it warms, expands, and becomes lighter. That rising air creates a pressure imbalance with the surrounding cooler, denser air. The atmosphere responds to this imbalance by generating waves, not unlike ripples spreading across a pond. These pressure waves can travel through the atmosphere. In some cases, they can interact with power infrastructure, particularly long-distance high-voltage transmission lines. These types of atmospheric waves are usually called gravity waves, thermal oscillations, or acoustic gravity waves. While the phrase induced atmospheric vibration is not formally established in meteorology, it seems to describe the same family of phenomenon. That's the end of a quote from the conversation. You can follow up with links in my blog at ecoshock.org. We can expect more of this. A team of Chinese authors from Sun Yat-sen University in Hangzhou just published this paper, Rapid Flips Between Warm and Cold Extremes in a Warming World. Find that in Nature Communications, April 22nd. As Christina Kelso reports in the New York Times, sweating to shivering, study finds rapid swings in temperature have increased. Does that sound familiar where you live? Rapid temperature changes damage crops and trees, but they can also affect the electric grid. This is another unreported way climate change can make lives harder.
Solar did it.
But the favorite whipping boy for Rupert Murdoch's press is dumping on renewable energy. From known rags to the Financial Times, lobbyists leap in to say, well, this is why we need more nuclear energy, or this is why we need coal plants. In Spain, solar is made out to be the boogeyman. Net zero blame for blackout chaos, says the Telegraph, pushing thank goodness for Brexit to protect the Brits from EU push for net zero. In Spain, the far-right party Vox called it woke to turn off nuclear and replace it with renewables. Everybody jumps on any disaster for profit and power. Naomi Klein's disaster capitalism. Solar power is taking over in Spain without a doubt. At the time of the blackout, it seems about half the national power came from solar installations, many of them in southern Spain. A Spanish official has suggested the problem may have come from overproduction by solar farms. A grid goes down when there is too much electricity, higher frequency, or too little, low frequency. In many countries, any surge of power from solar or wind is balanced by reducing that at conventional plants like oil and gas or electric power dams. Fossil-powered plants and hydro dams are easier to quickly turn up and down. This problem is well known, and so is the solution. Countries running with renewables need to install very large battery storage facilities. These can balance the load. Australia is the leading example. Battery storage works there, and it removes claimed needs to keep burning fossil fuels or building dangerous and expensive nuclear power plants. California is installing battery backup and balance at a fast rate. Experts agree this is what Spain needs. Don't believe the scare hype saying renewables kill the grid. If we want a planet cool enough to walk around and to eat food, fossil fuels and nuclear have to be over. Both of them are more expensive than wind and solar with batteries anyway. There is some good news. In a blackout, people work together. We don't know for how long. Radio and television reports from Spain and Portugal found people using common sense and showing generosity during the power outage. As the power sputtered back in patches, there are conflicting reports about how long electricity was out there. Some returned in 12 hours, but the general reporting is the blackout lasted about 23 hours. Most likely that is not enough to ruin all the food in freezers, especially if people kept them closed with blankets around them. Take note. Two experts from King's College in the UK looked into our response to blackouts. It is published in the International Journal of Disaster Risk Reduction in 2019. The title is Behavioral and Psychological Responses of the Public During a Major Power Outage, a Literature Review. Their findings we should all know because they reshape expectations and reduce the popular fear of one another in disasters. So here are their highlighted 8 key messages. Preparing the public should reduce the impact of an outage. Specific vulnerable groups, including older adults and those with psychiatric or medical conditions, will require targeted help to prepare. Clear public health communications will be needed to reduce, for example, carbon monoxide or food poisoning. The loss of communication infrastructure is likely to be an important stressor among the public. Panic is unlikely. Acts of altruism will probably outweigh acts of criminality. The public's information needs will focus on what has happened and when will the power be restored. Stick to that. And then we have these ways to prepare our social systems and infrastructure for the inevitable grid collapse. Again, this is Professor Benjamin Salvacool from the UK.
But there are at least fortuitously three different things that we can do to improve grid resilience, and they're at three different scales. So the first thing we can do is really invest in energy efficiency. Energy efficiency tends to have not only co-benefits for avoided emissions and jobs and resilience, but it also makes the grid more stable and more secure because you're using energy a lot more strategically than you would have been otherwise. And we've actually saved more energy through energy efficiency efforts in Europe than any single source of energy supply since the 1970s. The second intervention is to invest in grids. They don't sound very attractive. You want to invest in energy supply or maybe energy storage or other things like solar and wind, and the grid is perpetually uninvested in or underinvested in. And it isn't just the transmission grid, also local distribution grids. And even though it's 2025, you still have situations where people go to charge their Tesla and they cause a grid outage because those distribution grids just aren't up to par. And lastly, and I'm a huge fan of proponent of this, is invest in energy supply that is more distributed. We call this distributed generation or prosuming, where you put solar panels, wind, hydro, biogas, and other interventions close to your home or your factory or your hospital or your building.
Are we looking at more of this happening more often?
Absolutely. So the two metrics people often use to measure power outages are frequency and duration. Kind of frequency is how often they happen. Duration is how intensive they are. Do they last for an hour or a minute or days or weeks? And unfortunately, we're seeing increases in both the frequency and duration of blackouts. And climate change is actually aggravating both of them as well. The hotter it gets, and the more severe storms there are, the more severe wind events there are, the harder it is for electricity networks to deliver kilowatt hours or electrons to your home. And those are set to get almost twice as worse in the next 15 years, and potentially three times as worse by the end of the century. So I think we have this perfect storm brewing of we need electrification to solve climate change, but climate change is only making electricity systems far more vulnerable to disruption.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Finally, I've covered heat and blackout extensively with this program. For example, check out the show Heat Up, Grid Down, posted May 26, 2021. In the blog for that show, I listed out 12 reasons electric grids may fail as the climate heats up. And here they are, for the first time on radio. Number 1. A concurrent solar storm. The U.S. grid is poorly protected against an EMP event, an electromagnetic pulse. Number 2. Super demand from all those air conditioners and AC and particularly heat pumps cannot keep up past certain temperatures, so people keep them going full blast. Number 3, electric companies in California shut down the grid when there's a high wildfire risk, as they did in September 2019 during a heat wave. My local power company here in British Columbia said, yeah, they're just going to shut down if it gets hot and dry. Number 4, a concurrent drought may reduce available hydroelectric power. Number 5, too hot cooling water can shut down nuclear plants and coal plants too. Number 6, the grid works less efficiently and is more fragile during high heat. Number 7, concurrent terrorist attack or misguided social protest could break the grid at the same time during a heat wave. Number 8, concurrent wildfires burn down key transmission or production facilities as climate change increases. Number 9, heat sag is the major cause of transmission bottlenecks that result in brownouts and blackouts. That happens during the heat. We get more heat. Number 10, technical weakness within power lines during high heat, and I've got more during that program with an expert called Ray Klumpf about that. Number 11, very high temperatures also make it dangerous for outdoor workers like power maintenance people to do their job when the grid is threatened or goes down. And number 12, climate change denial is often strong in places where the risk of grid heat and failure are the greatest, like in Texas and Arizona. That leads to inaction and lack of public planning, and then poor care of people when it does get too hot. That's it from Alex Smith, 12 Reasons from my Radio EcoShock show, Heat Up, Grid Down, Why the Grid Could Fail as Climate Change Increases.
Radio EcoShock.
Earth has been much hotter in the distant past. Before the asteroid strike 66 million years ago, this planet went through 80 million years more or less as a greenhouse world. There was no ice at the poles, and sea level was hundreds of feet higher than today. That was the Cretaceous period. Within that, though, scientists are now finding signs of a time with similar sea surface temperatures as today and ice at the poles. Can we learn from that transition to understand the future? Will global warming make an ice-free world again? Dr. Robert Spicer is Emeritus Professor of Earth Sciences at Open University in the UK and currently a visiting professor at the Chinese Academy of Sciences. Dr. Spicer is co-author of the new paper, Back to an Ice-Free Future, Early Cretaceous Seasonal Cycles of Sea Surface Temperature and Glacier Ice. We find him in southern China. From China, Robert Spicer, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
It has been 18 years since we last spoke, and you explained how fossil leaf patterns reveal clues about the atmosphere and climate in distant times. We talked about the Cretaceous. Have you been studying deep time ever since, Robert?
Yes, I have. When we last spoke, I think most of my research was focused on the Arctic and how in the Cretaceous, the near polar regions of northern Alaska, it was closer to the pole then, hosted diverse forests with dinosaurs running around. That was in the Maastrichtian. Since then, I've been doing a lot of work combining looking at the fossil record with numerical climate modeling with my colleagues at Bristol University in the UK. And since about 1995, I also started an interest in looking at how we can use plant fossils to tell past surface heights, in particular the growth of the Tibetan Plateau and surrounding mountains, and how those have influenced the development of the monsoon. Right now, I'm in Sichuanbana Tropical Botanical Garden in southernmost China near Myanmar and Laos, and our monsoon started 2 days ago. We've had months of dryness, and now it rains pretty much every day.
Has it been hot lately?
It was. It was when I first arrived. Now it's cooled down, and the monsoon has arrived more or less on schedule. About 2 weeks ago, the local Dai people had their water festival, and this is at the end of the dry season in anticipation of the onset of the monsoon. And now here we are. It's raining. Yesterday was torrential rain. And the Earth system, so far, in this part of the world, is behaving as we expect.
So was the Cretaceous generally hotter than now? Was it a greenhouse world?
Yes, it was. The hottest part of the Cretaceous was around the middle of the Cretaceous, let's say 100 million years ago. And during the late Cretaceous, temperatures gradually declined through to the Maastrichtian. And, of course, at the end of the Maastrichtian, that's when we have the demise of the dinosaurs. So there's an awful lot of debate about whether the dinosaur and other biota were being stressed by what we know was a very variable climate regime in that cool interval. But the focus of this work, and I need to correct you slightly, the material that we use for this actually came from Madagascar, but were analyzed in China. The material for this work is focused at a much earlier time, the early part of the Cretaceous, 133 million years ago, in what is called the Valanginian. Now, at that time, there was an event, a global event called the Wissert event, and this is named after Helmut Wissert, who first detected it. And basically, it's a sudden drawdown of atmospheric carbon. So carbon is being sucked out of the atmosphere. Normally, in ocean systems, we see that as a dark layer in ocean sediments. We call it an anoxic event, where the bottom of the ocean lacks oxygen, and so the carbon is preserved. Well, on this occasion, there really isn't so much of that, but what there is on land is the development of a lot of coal. So we think perhaps the carbon drawdown was associated with something going on land rather than in the ocean. The drawdown of the CO2 led to a reduction in temperature. And when we look around the world, particularly at higher latitudes, we see evidence of ice in the form of things called drop stones, which are ordinary stones that are rafted out into the ocean on ice sheets. The ice melts, and the stones end up in anomalous positions within the sediments. There are deposits called chilites, which are produced by glaciers. There's a number of temperature readings that we can get from proxies in the ocean that suggest cool conditions, and something called glendonites, which is a mineral that only forms in cold conditions, less than plus 5 degrees Celsius. All of these suggest that the Vissert event was associated with some degree of ice, particularly at high latitudes. And so what we've been trying to do is look at the oysters that are found in northern Madagascar. And these oysters are found by Dr. Hasina Narina Ranjanali from the Antananarivo University in Madagascar. And she met up with the lead author of this paper called He Song Lin, who had just finished his PhD at the time. He was working at the Institute of Tibetan Plateau Research, which I'm affiliated with. And he got excited about the fact that he saw in this material a series of very well-defined growth rings. Now, oysters put more shell on each year, and so their growth is expressed in rings pretty much like you see in trees. And these rings were beautifully preserved, and he thought maybe he could analyze these rings for their constituent minerals, and in particular what we call clumped isotopes that will record a temperature signal. And that's what he did. I mean, what he did was really quite extraordinary. He used a micro drill to remove very, very small pieces of shell, 0.5 millimeters apart. So there's 20 of these samples in a centimeter. And he was able to analyze these for the carbon-13 and oxygen-18 bonds within the calcite. Now, the ratio of those, or the amount of those linked bonds of carbon-13 and oxygen-18, which are slightly heavier versions of the normal carbon-12, oxygen-16, the amount of that dual bonding in the calcite is directly related to the temperature at which the calcite was formed, the mineral, the carbonate mineral of the shell. And as a consequence, he was able to extract not just mean signals of the temperature in the ocean in northern Madagascar, but seasonal variations at this time in the past.
Were the seasons more variable during this period?
Well, what's remarkable is that if you look at the rest of the Cretaceous, it clearly is a warm world. As I said before, we've got forest at the poles and all this kind of thing. And the seasonal variation is different to now. What is captured in these oyster shells is that 133 million years ago, during this cool event, the seasons are just, or seasonal surface temperatures of the ocean were exactly as we see today. What's also captured in the chemistry of these shells are indications of things like salinity and the composition of seawater. And again, they are very similar to what we see today. So the idea that emerged from this finding is that this cool interval in the Cretaceous probably is a good analog for where we are heading in the very, very near future as we continue to warm the planet. It's worth bearing in mind that the calculations that you can do from the composition of the seawater and the shells is that the ice fields in the polar regions were maybe half what they are today. Sea level might have been as much as 60 meters higher than the present, and we would have a very strong oscillation between winter and summer as the seasons, where the ice builds up in the polar winter, whichever hemisphere it is, and then melts again in the summer. So there's big oscillation in ice field development at each pole as each year goes on. An unstable, if you like, situation. And bearing in mind that these kinds of seasonal oscillations have profound effect on the way that the climate system overall operates, we propose that this time in the past is a good one to use to get real-world information of how the world may well respond, possibly in the next few centuries.
Yes, this was a new idea to me, that Earth may not go straight from current polar ice caps to ice-free, but might first encounter a long period where ice forms on Greenland during the winter and Antarctica during the summer, like alternating polar ice caps, as you just discussed. That seems like a different version, and we might run into it.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, the Antarctica, for example, is one big ice cube, and it takes a lot of energy to melt that ice. So the oscillations that may have been expressed in this past time are less pronounced in the modern world, because the temperature, particularly in the southern, is buffered by the big southern ice cap. Now, as that melts, there is less buffering. And in the Arctic, of course, the ice is melting much, much faster than it is in Antarctica. And so the northern hemisphere may well suffer these big oscillations, seasonal oscillations, long before Antarctica does. And we've tested these ideas using numerical climate models. And what was really gratifying is that the climate models were able to reproduce extremely well the kind of signals that we see in the oysters. So we're able to get the climate model to fractionate isotopes in the same way as they do in reality. And what we see is everything that we interpret from the proxies reflected in the numerical climate model. The advantage of the model is that we can test out ideas that go beyond the particular location we're looking at, or the spotty, incomplete data that we have in the geological record, and we can build a much more complete picture of the world back then, and also understand the processes that underlie it. And if you run such climate models, what you do see is this big seasonal switch from pole to pole, with the development of significant amounts of snow. In the climate models, the snow tends to run throughout the year. In other words, it can accumulate at the kind of kind of carbon dioxide levels that we are heading to very quickly. In other words, two times pre-industrial, or 560 parts per million by volume. And this is our future. In a few decades' time, we will be there. And under those conditions, back in the Valanginian, we can see that the climate model is telling us that the general interpretation of the rock patterns is right. And now we can go elsewhere in the Valanginian and see in the real world exactly how the Earth system responded to those conditions.
Bob Spicer, tell us about your work in China.
In relation to this particular study, it exploits the wonderful facilities that they have at the Institute of Tibetan Plateau Research. There's vast rooms full of mass spectrometers that can do very fancy analyses, and a wonderful body of expertise there. My particular interest in working in China at the moment is to refine our techniques for measuring past surface height. As I mentioned to you before, a lot of my work in recent years has been focused in the Tibetan region, what we call the Pan-Tibetan Highlands, that include the plateau and the Himalaya and the Hengrun Mountains. And I've been developing techniques based on leaf architecture or leaf form that can tell us reasonably accurately how high mountains were or plateau were in the past. The principle of one technique is based on conservation of energy. And in a nutshell, plant leaves are able to capture a property of the atmosphere known as moist enthalpy, which is a function of temperature and moisture, two things plants are really interested in. So unsurprisingly, the leaf form, the population of plants in a given area, tend to reflect those conditions in the atmosphere. Now, using moist enthalpy, we can determine surface height. And it's a very simple relationship. If you measure moist enthalpy at sea level, and we've got lots of fossil assemblages at sea level that can provide this. And when we don't have the fossils, we can use, again, the climate models to obtain moist enthalpy at sea level. And we find a fossil assemblage, let's say, on the Tibetan plateau. We analyze that fossil assemblage, and we can determine the moist enthalpy then. And if we know the date and that we're dealing with, and we know that we've got sea level floras of the same age, the difference in moist enthalpy between those two fossil assemblages, divided by the acceleration due to gravity, which is a constant through time, gives us the height difference. And using that, we've been able to, in the last 10 years or so, completely overturn our ideas about the growth of the Tibetan Plateau. Originally, it was thought that, you know, India comes in from the south and collides with Asia, and that basically plowing into Asia caused the Asian crust to rise and form the modern plateau. We now know from these kinds of techniques that the landscape prior to the arrival of India was much more complicated. We have, instead of the Himalaya, we have a mountain range running east-west along the southern margin of Eurasia called the Gangdese Arc. North of that is a wide, deep valley with subtropical vegetation. We've called it Shangri-La vegetation because it's a hidden valley in Tibet after the novel Lost Horizon that was made into a movie by Hollywood in the 1930s. And then north of that, there is another mountain range called the Changtang mountain range, caused by an earlier collision of what is now the southern part of the Tibetan Plateau with Eurasia. That earlier collision occurred in the late Jurassic, early Cretaceous, the time we've just been talking about with the oysters. And then, of course, India comes along and starts colliding probably around 65 million years ago. The result of the Indian collision is that we get the Changtang terrain extruded to the east. That raises eastern Tibet. That, using climate models, we can tell that generates an increase in rainfall. Gradually, we get the central Tibetan Valley rises moving towards the west. We get the plateau at around 23 million years. The modern plateau is formed. That again changes all the climate. And around 15 million years, we have the Himalaya reaching the height of the then plateau and the present plateau. And then after that, the Himalaya builds a big southern wall. Tibet dries out, and we get the modern monsoon. So is that an answer to your question?
It certainly is. You are a time traveler, and it's always interesting to talk with you because I learn things I just never knew before. As we wrap up here, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
You mentioned I'm a time traveler. I suppose I am, in a way. I spent all my career thinking about deep time and what it's like to live there. And I would just leave you with this. Back in 2017, I was approached by the BBC to join a project that was going to make a wildlife documentary with Sir David Attenborough doing the voiceover, just like the blue chip wildlife documentaries called Blue Planet and Life on Earth and this kind of thing. The only difference was it was going to be set 66 million years ago. And for somebody who spends his entire life thinking what it was like back then, this was a dream come true. So I would encourage anyone out there who is at all interested in fossils to look at the wonderful animations that there now are in the form of Prehistoric Planet, which is on Apple TV, and to get thinking about our world of the past, because that world of the past, unlike the climate models, tells us just how quickly the Earth can respond to perturbations. And one thing we have learned is that ice sheets can respond remarkably fast to warming. And that personally worries me, because I think at the moment we are underestimating what the future will be like in the not-so-distant future. I mean decades and the next century. So do take climate change very seriously. We've seen it happen in the past without human interference. Our human interference is just turbocharging the whole process and, in a sense, taking us back to the future.
From southern China, we've been talking with Professor Emeritus Robert Spicer, and you can find links to all the science we talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Bob Spicer, thank you so much for talking with us again.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Be blackout ready. Get some candles and a battery-operated radio. Keep extra food at home. Have plenty of water around. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Hands on the dial, sunburned and blind. Winds howl thick smoke, no stars aligned. Dust clouds choke skies, no more blue. Climate killing headlines, you know they're true. Fast fury rushing on a dead end street. Scorched earth screams underneath our feet. Chain the sun and cage the breeze. But we all burn with gasoline disease.